What's up, everybody? John Bush here from the Mighty Armored Saint, and you're watching Justin with Monsters, Madness, and Magic. Crank it up.
All right, folks, welcome to the Monsters, Madness, and Magic podcast. I'm your host, Justin, here with a quick word before we dive in. Now, in this episode, I chat with musician John Bush of Armored Saint about Hellraiser 3, managing musical input amongst band members, tough tours, his days with Anthrax, and more. As always, thank you all for listening out there. And if you're listening on your podcasting platform of choice and you'd like to help the show grow, please leave us a review. And if you happen to be watching the video on YouTube, please like, comment, and subscribe because it does help. Anyway, without further ado, here you go.
Greetings, boils and ghouls. This is your comrade, the Crypt Keeper here, reporting dead from the Sanctuary of the Strange. Tonight's macabre myth is a fright-filled feature, one overflowing with monsters, madness, and magic.
All right, John, Mr. Bush, take us back in time. You're a youngster. Are you a book reader, fort builder, troublemaker, or all the above?
Good question. I was a pretty good book reader when I was a kid, like elementary school. I was really never a good fort maker, although we did these really cool concerts when we were kids. We set up for a neighbor, and it was actually me, Joey, Gonzo, and my next-door neighbor, David, and we'd set up these concerts for kids in the neighborhood, and we would, you know, play on tennis rackets and stuff. And that was pretty cool. So that was very creative, but I wasn't really building forts, but I was in the creative element with music. You know, I was a troublemaker to some degree, but my wife was way worse. So she's always like, that's nothing, you know? So I'm like, yeah.
A little bit of everything.
A little bit of all.
Yeah. So you said you read a little bit. What kind of books were you reading back then?
Well, I mean, as a kid, you know, I was reading in elementary school. I can't even remember what I was reading. But what was really cool is actually we wrote a couple books. I was writing stories about sports because I was into sports. And so I was kind of like taking the journalistic approach of actually writing. And then me and Joey did this crazy, we made up this like crazy fictitious bands and we wrote a whole book about it, and they were based on teachers and students from our elementary school and junior high. It was not PC at all. It was pretty like crazy provocative stuff. So we can't really, I mean, you know, now I wouldn't really care, but it was pretty gnarly stuff. Like we pretended some of the teachers were like probably gay and, you know, some weird stuff. I don't know, man. It was, and then some of the students we were pretty harsh with. We're probably, you know, some of the kids that were not really popular and, you know, probably, you know, having some kind of living in the shadows. And then we picked on it. We wrote the story, but we made these really funny, cool bands based out of these people. It was really creative. And Joey sells the book, and we looked at it one night. We were hammered and we were just cracking up. And I got to show this to some other friends, because we still have a lot of friends that we grew up with in our neighborhood. And, you know, the story with Armored Saint is that Gonzo, Phil, Joey, and I, we grew up in the same neighborhood with each other and known each other since like we were 9 years old. So we have this long history of friendship, long history of friends, friendship with other friends from our neighborhoods. It's pretty funny. And I'm sure everybody could kick out of that. And it was very creative. It was very creative. So I wasn't reading as much as I was writing. So
that's pretty cool, man.
It was really cool. And it was funny. It was really funny stuff. So we had a dark sense of humor even back then.
So were you just interested as a spectator, or did you play sports too?
No, I played sport for a while until I got to about high school, and then I just kind of merged into music. Played Pop Warner football. I wasn't that good, although I did have like a game-winning TD that I caught that sent the team into the final game, the championship game. That was like my awesome sport memory. And then the next year I quit, and my mom was the team mom of the team, which is ironic because now my son plays hockey and has for years, and my wife has been the manager of the team for years. But yeah, you know, I said, I'm done. And they're like, what? And I'm done. I want to get into music. I want to change. I don't want to play football anymore. And I got a lot of grief from people. Not my mom, of course. She stood behind me. But it was weird because she stayed as the team mom for the team the next year. And then the next year, the team won the championship, which is funny because the year that I caught the pass to take us in, we went to the championship game and got crushed. Still a big basketball fan, still play pickup basketball actually once a week. It's probably one of the many aspects of being a little bummed about touring that I won't be able to do my pickup weekly basketball game. I don't know, maybe I'll find some courts along the way in the country and try to get in some games or something. Probably won't happen. But yeah, love sports still, you know, being a sports fan. I see a lot of connections between sports and music and the fan base, is, of course.
Have you filled out a bracket?
I didn't do that. I'm more of a pro NBA basketball fan than college, but I've been watching a bunch of the games. And is Carolina, South Carolina in?
No, I don't know, because I'm with you. I don't really watch. I watch pro, I mean, but I think... Yeah, I'm a pro guy.
Yeah, you know, it's awesome. You know, the tournament is amazing, and, you know, you're one and done, so you got to win. Got to run the table.
You're a Lakers fan, I'm assuming?
I don't, actually. I mean, I'm not. I really actually love the Celtics, and that's a weird thing because I grew up my whole life. I don't know if it was – I got into Larry Bird in the 80s, and that was it. I don't know. I probably do it more so than anything. It's probably because I'm a nemesis to most of my friends.
Yeah.
It gives them a reason to rally around hating the Celtics and hating me.
So yeah.
It's all in good fun.
Yeah, yeah. So were either your parents, were they artistically or musically inclined at all? You think that's where your roots come from?
Absolutely not. absolutely not. My dad was a cement mixer driver for most of his life, blue-collar guy. Always, they were both super supportive through the years, of course, of me playing music, which was great. She was just, you know, kind of a housewife, and we drove the kids around a lot, which is kind of funny because that's what me and my wife do a lot. We tag team driving my kid because he plays a high-level hockey, and there's a lot of traveling, and where he's played the last couple of years is about an hour and a half from where we live. So a lot of miles on the car, a lot of time spent in the car, in traffic, in L.A. but, you know, it's what you do for your kids and stuff. And that's what my mom and dad did. And they were always there for me. So yeah, I don't know where I got that from, to be honest. I think my next door neighbor is the guy who really kind of started my path in music. He was he was a very creative guy, played guitar, was okay. Probably thought he was better than he was. But just a really adventurous person. And he discovered so many bands that went on to be popular that before they were anyone, like Thin Lizzy and Queen and, you know, all these various groups that before they even had any popularity in America, he discovered them and turned us on to them, me and Joey and Gonzo. And it was cool. He was really adventurous that way, like I said. And his name was David Avila, and I think he was a guy who started a talent show band that me and Joey ended up being in.
Oh.
And he wanted me to be the singer, and he just said, you kind of have the singer model, because I couldn't sing at that point. I was only like 13. It probably sounded terrible, but it was the beginning of playing music, and so I really owe it to him, to be honest.
Are you guys still in contact?
I think he passed away some years back. Unfortunately, had some health issues. Yeah, it was a big drag. He was a big component in inspiring a lot of people in our neighborhood about music. And then I think people kind of, some people gravitated past him, which is a bummer. That's sometimes the way things go.
So before we get too far away from your childhood, when you think back to formative films and TV shows you grew up on, what comes to mind?
Well, it's funny. I think of like the high school years is when movies really became such a big part of our lives. Certainly Animal House, because we emulated that in our own high school. And that was where a lot of mischief came from. And we did all those things, like threw toilet paper in the trees and flour in front of the school and moon people. You know, we were just into all that stuff. We were so inspired by the movie Animal House and John Belushi. And also The Road Warrior had a big impact on us. And obviously, it's kind of how we modeled our look. And even though a lot of people did anyway, we're just really inspired by that. Vacation, a lot of comedies, Fletch, you know, Chevy Chase was amazing back then. And always found the humor and stuff. And, you know, Arsenio actually has a little humor that I don't think ever really kind of comes across, but we really do. And I try to kind of instill that in some songs and the way I write and way I kind of like look at things in life. And always trying to find a little slight humor to, I mean, it's not in every song, of course, but
Right.
there are a lot of songs that people probably won't even pick up on that I'm really trying to be funny about. We're not all that serious. Not really.
So before you met that buddy of yours that put you on to, the heavy metal side of things, what kind of records were spinning around the house when you were growing up?
Well, I was listening to the Beatles when I was really little because I had two older brothers who passed on music to me. Zeppelin, Sabbath, my older brother was playing that. He was 7 years older than me, so he was playing that. I remember him playing the first Black Sabbath song and turning all the lights off and just me and him, and his ambition, I think, was to scare me, which it did, but it was so inspiring at the same time. And so, that had a big impact. Like I said, I remember writing Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath on my notebook in, 4th grade, 9 years old. So, I mean, I was really into that. And then I was into a lot of pop music. It's funny, I listened to Sirius 70s on 7, whatever. I mean, I would say the majority of the time songs on that station they play, and that's mostly pop music, I had a lot of those records and loved those songs, loved those bands, which it was, whether it was like The Sweet or Chicago or Earth, Wind and Fire or Elton John, of course Zeppelin, and you name it just goes on and on. And a lot of it was pop, a lot of pop music that was amazing pop at the time, and incredible artists that have stood the test of time.
So what about your very first time on stage, whatever you consider that to be? Did your pants fall down, go off smoothly? How did it go?
That was the show, the talent show that my buddy put on. And it was great. The kids were all into it, because most of the people, there was a couple of people that were just air guitaring it. And we actually went out there and played. As I said, it probably sounded terrible, but we still did it. And I think a lot of people were very into it. So it was great. It was the private little bug that started it all. And really, that was the beginning of playing. And then eventually we formed another band. Kind of a small version of Armored Saint, before we were Armored Saint, called Royal Decree, but it was still Gonzo Film, Joey, myself. And then that happened for a while, played some backyard parties, a lot of fun, had some gigs around the local neighborhoods, played a theater, a Cameo Theater, which is a movie theater in the neighborhood. They put on a couple concerts, we did it. That eventually kind of fell by the wayside, but of course it re kind of instilled once Dave came into the picture and Gonzo and Phil started playing with him. Once we met Dave in high school, and then that was the beginning of Armored Saint. And actually, Joey was the guy who was the last guy coming in 1982.
Gotcha. And I think you just mentioned a few minutes ago that you were 13 and you didn't think you could sing very well. When did that confident, where did the confidence come from eventually? Was it your friend saying, "Hey man, you kind of got some pipes here," or something like that?
Well, you're going through puberty and stuff, and so you're not, I mean, how good can you really sing when unless you were somebody who was maybe taking choir or something, probably learned the proper way to sing, which I never did. I think that you're just trying to figure stuff out. Really, for me, it was spending hours, countless hours in my garage, emulating people like Phil Mogg and Robert Plant and Rob Halford and Bon Scott and Lionel Richie and Maurice White and people like Stevie Wonder and all the various people that had inspiration on me through the years, just singing to them, singing to those records, countless hours probably helped me kind of develop something. And the key was, I think the key from very on, well, probably around high school, maybe a little after, the goal was to try to develop my own thing. As much as I loved all these singers, I didn't want to sound like them. I just wanted to use them all for motivation to develop my own style, which is what I did. And that's the thing that I always kind of rest my hat on, is just trying to sound like myself. So when you hear it, you're like, that's Bush. And that's the most important thing. I don't have some like, 4 octave range voice, or it's always going to be scratchy, a little scratchier right now because we've been working on rehearsing, but just about trying to sound unique. That's really the most important thing that I've always kind of strove for. And that's, I think, what Armored Saint was always striving for as well, is to try to figure out our own identity. It took a while to get that, but we finally, I think, developed it.
Well, no one sounds like you, man, so you definitely pulled that off.
Well, I have a kind of unique style. I mean, I'm very bluesy. I try to incorporate a lot of soul singing, people like James Brown and You know, like I said, you know, Leon Bridges is a rad singer right now in the modern age, you know, soul singer. And Black Puma is a really cool, again, another soulful singer. It's not metal, but it's a great band. Josh Homme is an awesome singer, you know, of Queens of the Stone Age. I mean, there's that. I think, again, listening to somebody who sounds unique, special. I mean, to me, Lemmy was a great singer because he sounded like Lemmy. Nobody sounded like him. So I think it's all about just kind of having your own style.
Right. Agreed. So did you ever have to deal with or overcome stage fright, anything like that?
Not really. I don't really think that was something that was an issue for me. You know, I wouldn't say they're butterflies, but I do feel like, I don't know what it is exactly. You know, it's something before a gig where you're like preparing and just wanting to make sure that you're going to be good and sound good. But I wouldn't say it's stage fright. It's not something that's a hindrance or making me fearful about actually going out there. It's probably a little anxiety and build up at the same time with nerves and energy. And you know, I get it sometimes more than off, other times more often than others. But I think that's a good thing because I mean, I think if you're feeling something like, you know, in complacency or indifference about going on stage, then that's probably when you should stop. You should always feel a little bit of like, oh, here we go. And how am I going to be? And you know, how's the crowd and all that stuff. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, all that pretty much shows that you still give a damn, you know?
Exactly.
So, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but you know, you guys decide to part in 1990. Was there any hesitancy on your part when you got the call from Scott Ian to join Anthrax, or were you itching to get back on the stage by that point?
Well, I actually got the call from Johnny Z, who was the manager of the band at the time originally. Yeah, you know, it was a difficult decision. We always have this kind of weird, psychotic love for Armored Saint, where it's like you're abandoning it, but you know, maybe that's what the path that's being pulled you down, and you kind of it's hard to kind of resist it, and that's what happened. But it wasn't an easy decision. As a matter of fact, I originally first said no. And then they came back and go, do you want to reconsider? And I talked to a couple of friends outside the band, and they're like, dude, what are you doing? And so I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe that's a bad decision. So, but it's, you know, we grew up together, so there's this real serious loyalty that we have, for better or worse. Sometimes it's dysfunctional, but you know, what are you gonna do? It's a good thing, but yeah, it was hard to walk away that, especially after Dave had just died. We made Symbol of Salvation, which is the record that like almost didn't happen. We had all these amazing songs, but we did struggle still to get the success that we kind of thought we shouldn't be getting at that time. And remember, it was 1991, 92 was the beginning of the 90s. You know, metal was taking a big backseat to a lot of the music that was coming out, and everything was changing and morphing into the 90s, which is a good thing because incredible bands. And it was time. Now, what are you gonna, you know, it was something I couldn't deny in the end, especially once I heard the music that eventually became the song only because it was sounding so unique and just so cutting edge at the time, especially for Anthrax.
You mentioned a few minutes ago that the guys in Armored Saint, that it took you felt like it took you guys a while to find your sound. When do you think you accomplished that?
Well, I think Symbol of Salvation was kind of the beginning of it. I really think we were always adventurous with doing things. So, you know, I joke, and we've talked about this, that I think in the early days we had a little inferiority complex because we were from LA and we played with all the bands that were from LA, bands like Rat and Great White and Steeler and Wasp and, you know, Black and Blue and you name it. But we were always a little heavier than those bands. We were always kind of more modeled after the European bands and Priest and Scorpions and Lizzy. And so we always had a little more of a edge to our sound than I think those bands did. They sounded like they were from LA, and great bands, killer bands, right? And it wasn't that different. It wasn't like, you know, that extreme that we didn't belong on the bill together. We certainly did, but we were really kind of going for the European sound, and we were really just kind of going that way, especially with Maiden and Motörhead and Saxon. That was having an impact on us. So we played with those bands and we had great shows together, but like I said, we were kind of sounding a little different. But we weren't also part of the thrash movement, which was also blossoming at that time. Bands like, you know, Exodus and Metallica, of course, and Slayer and, you know, and Anthrax and eventually Testament, whatever. You know, we didn't really sound like that either, even though we played with some of those bands. And I felt like we we were heavy at times. I mean, Madhouse, March of the Saint, Listen, We'll Learn, these were really powerful, sometimes fast songs, but we still also had songs like Take a Turn and Aftermath and Over the Edge, which is like kind of a bluesy number, could easily be on like an Aerosmith record. So we really were slightly all over the place, which I think in the end was a good thing, mm-hmm. but it didn't help us join either one of those groups that were really going, that were having a ton of success, the hair bands and then the thrash bands. We were kind of in the middle somewhere, and probably it affected writing because we weren't sure exactly, like we were following our own gut, but in the end, outside influences and you know, seeing bands have more success than perhaps we were, probably was confusing us. It wasn't until right around Symbol Salvation and the writing for that, we got dropped by Chrysalis. We found out about Dave's illness because we found out he had leukemia. So everything was, the future was extremely uncertain. And because of that, we just said, okay, well, what can we control here? We can control just writing tunes. It's all we can do. We're dropped. We don't know when we're going to get another deal, if that'll happen. It was crazy because we were only like 25 years old. We're super young still and had all this experience under our belt. But we were, the future was in doubt. So we just kind of said, let's write. Let's just kind of follow our own instincts and write whatever we want. And if we write something heavy, great. We want to write a long, epic kind of, you know, ballad, love to love type song like UFO had, then we're going to do it. And we're not going to care. And then those songs are the ones that eventually became Symbol Salvation. And it was real clear when we went out and did the Symbol Salvation record in its entirety a couple of years back, how amazing that album is, because it is really diverse. You can start with Rain of Fire, Dropping Like Flies, and you go into Not Straying Home, and you have Another Day, and The Truth Always Hurts, and then, you know, Hanging Judge, it sounds really old school. Then you have Tainted Past, which is kind of this epic song. I'm skipping a couple tunes here, but, you know, then ends with Spineless, which sounds like it could be on an Anthrax record. So it all worked. It all worked. And that was the record, I think, that really kind of cemented our style, if you will.
While we're on Symbol of Salvation, I believe that's where you guys got the song on Hellraiser 3.
We did. Well, actually, we were in the movie, but we didn't actually have a song on the record, which was really lame. And I don't know how that happened, why that happened, because, you know, the song, the Motorhead song was really big on that, and we were in the movie. So it was a situation like that is like classic Armored Saint, like where everything doesn't just completely come together. There's something off. It just never fails. It's like kind of been, you know, story of our career in a weird way. I'm not bitter or complaining. It's right. Funny, but it's just like, that's a perfect example of so many things where the pegs didn't quite meet, you know, and the pegs in the hole, they were like off. So I was like, why are we not on the sound check? And it was ironic because we actually wrote the song The Pillar, which actually eventually was on the Revelation record, which we've been rehearsing. We're going to play live, which is cool. It's a great song. It's just a real thumper and straightforward and great riff. We wrote it for that reason, and it didn't make it.
So how did you guys find yourself in the movie?
I don't even remember how that happened. You know, I mean, again, 1991, it was Symbol of Salvation tour. We were in the middle of the tour of the Wrathchild America and Last Crack. It was not a great tour. We were all in a van with the band and crew. So we had like 10 people riding in this like passenger van with all our suitcases everywhere, garbage all over the van, lots of bickering, kind of a mutiny happening with the crew over our tour manager who was his first tour ever. Ironically enough, he's our agent now, went on to do very well for himself in the music business, but he was taking a lot of abuse from these crew guys who were veterans, and they were really getting mad at him, and it was creating all this dissension, and it started seeping into the band. It was bad, actually. It was a terrible tour. Bad memories.
Oh, that's no.
That's why I'm glad we went back at the Symbol in its entirety, because we kind of exercised that demon out of us a little bit. We were on the road for that, and somebody said, you're going to be in this movie. I guess it was management at the time, or maybe the label. So we had like 3 days off where the bands went on, I think. And we went to North Carolina where we filmed it, actually. Not south, but north, somewhere outside of Charlotte, I think. And we spent a couple of days making, you know, filming a movie there. It was real cool. We met the guy who was Pinhead. It was awesome. You know? I don't really think Hellraiser 3 is one of the better Hellraisers.
It's not.
It's not. And I think we were actually supposed to be killed in the movie, but that really didn't happen. But we're in the club scene where they come in and they kill a bunch of people. And a couple of us were supposed to be killed, but I don't remember seeing that. Yeah, the first two were better.
It's just hilarious that you guys had all this shitty stuff going on, and then you end up on Hellraiser. That was almost perfect.
It would have been more perfect if we were killed, yeah. Right? I mean, that would have been, but that didn't even work.
Yeah.
So anyway, so yeah, sense of humor about this stuff. You got to, right? Because, you know, I feel like our career's kind of gone that way. And if anything, it's really just created a lot of resistance and stamina, and yeah, I don't know what the right words are, but just, you know, a lot of belief, because things like that have happened. I mean, look at the, you know, we did the Wasp tour, it was killer, and then started playing a second leg, and then Blackie got hurt, and, you know, granted, he was injured and he couldn't do it, and what are you gonna do? But then the tour canceled, so they're like, oh no, and it almost affected the Squeezewright tour, but in the end it didn't. But, you know, that's, it's just like, those are the kind of things that seems like it happens to Armor Saint all the time. And we just keep going.
I meant to ask you this a few minutes ago. How did you guys settle on the name Armored Saint?
That's Gonzo's claim to fame. We always give him the credit for that, because he drilled it in, even times when we were mocking him and saying, that name's terrible, stupid. And he was like, what? It's great. Look at the imagery. Like, it's silly. Sounds like wannabe maiden. And I don't know, but it's, you know, it is what it is, what we're called now. It's just part of who we are. You know, that's kind of what led to wearing some of those costumes in the early days, trying to, again, separate from the pack, even though we look back and I do have some laughter about it. But it was cool at the time. It was a pain in the ass because they were all sweaty and never would dry, and it was gross, you know, putting that stuff on the next day, like, oh God, you're in Buffalo, New York, and it's freezing, and you're putting on this cold leather that's not drying. I hate this stuff. Anyways, yeah, you know, it was a name that we went to go see Excalibur, I think, the movie. It was, again, another movie that had an impact on us when we were wide-eyed and 17, 18, and probably getting high, and, you know, seeing these movies that were just so visually stimulating, and that was another one. And so he came up with a name after, and we're like, it's terrible. And I don't even know what that, actually, to be honest, but kept going, kept coming back. Armored Saint, man. Armored Saint. And we're like, all right, we need a name. Let's do it.
Hey, it worked.
It is who we are.
What was the catalyst that got you guys back together in 99, I believe it was?
It was actually, you know, we had a little hiatus in Anthrax. Scott and Charlie did that SOD record with Billy Milano and Dan Loker. They kind of did their follow-up years later. And they were writing songs for that. And so I was really not doing anything. It's Doug, you know, me and Joey always stayed in close contact and very close friends. And he's like, I got some ideas. You want to mess around with some? And I was like, send them to me. A couple months later, I'm like, I wrote lyrics to all these songs. And he's like, what? And so we demoed them. And that was kind of the beginning of the way we've kind of worked since then, actually. Demoing songs, singing them at his house. And those are great songs. After Me the Flood, Pay Dirt, Tension. And then we had some leftover songs from Saint that we never recorded, like Creepy Feelings and What's Your Pleasure, Upon My Departure. No, that was an old song, because actually Dave played on the demo. So we had enough to make a record, because we had some new tunes and we had some of these old ones. So it was like, okay, they're going to do that. And I, you know, let's do it. Let's do a Saint record. So we did. And I was always with the mindset that Anthrax was going to resume, and I was part of that. But it was fun, and we made Revelation. It's a killer record, and, you know, we did some touring on it, played some cool shows, Wacken, I think, in Germany in 2000. So it's cool. Like, Metal Blade, I think, is re-releasing that record along with La Raza, which came out 10 years later. That's a cool album. I think Revelation is like, it sounds very Armored Saint.
Was there a point where you were pulling double duty for Saint and Anthrax? Could you tell that the writing was on the wall for one or the other? Did you have a problem doing that?
That was never really an issue, because when Anthrax resumed, I just went back. You know, my days in Anthrax became numbered when there was the talk of doing a reunion started to surface, which in retrospect, you know, I probably inevitably always thought the day was one day going to come. So was mentally prepared for it. We were touring in South America, And it was, the talk was everywhere. And we were doing press conferences and people were asking, what about this reunion? You know, and it was uncomfortable because everyone, we didn't really discuss it candidly, which is pretty lame. And then so I was, you know, I knew, but I was quiet and they would kind of like, what are you talking about? What? They know, what do you, say something. That's stupid, really, in retrospect. But you know, sometimes communication wasn't the greatest. I don't want to go off on a limb and say that maybe is a problem for the guys in Anthrax still sometimes. you know, it's like, you know, I mean, it's, you want to have solid communication as a band, even if you're touching subjects that are difficult, because that's the way it is. But, you know, whatever, it, you know, eventually I knew that doing those shows could be very well my last. And so did my wife, because she came and met me in Mexico City with my daughter, who was 4 months old. And she was like, if this is your last show, then she's going to be here. Of course, she's not going to remember it because she's a baby. But it was really cool. It was an amazing gesture she made. And, you know, it was the, it was my last show for a while. I came back and did some shows in between when they had the other guy, Dan Nelson, and Joey kind of returned again the second time. We played some cool shows in Nebworth in England. And I did a tour of Australia, Soundwaves Festival. And we played Loud Park in Japan, which all those were great. But I never really thought I'm coming back, you know, again. I would say, man, like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Belladonna is meant to be there. It's, you know, it's his voice, it's his sound. I love what I did. We've done great stuff. We made amazing records. I'm super proud of those albums. I think there's amazing songs there. But, you know, just feels right where it is now. And Anthrax is, we always struggle to compete with Anthrax in the 80s, let alone all the other bands. You know, so here you are competing almost against yourself. It's not easy. You know, it's really, it's a challenge when you're doing that. And, but, you know, again, taking nothing away from the music we made. I think we made some really killer music. And I think it was, we were embracing the time. The 90s came and we certainly weren't trying to emulate Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, but man, they were having an impact. They were amazing bands. And it was cool to have this whole new vibe and scene go. And Anthrax, I felt like, was doing that. Sound of White Noise sounded very modern, especially compared to Among the Living and stuff, which was only like 6 years before that.
And not picking on Anthrax specifically here, but you did mention communication and just interviewing musicians and actors and stuff. It always seems that when issues arise, it's never, 99% of the time, it's never music related.
I don't know if I'd agree with that, but, because actually sometimes it is music related. It's a lot of the time it's bands and members, you know, not getting enough music being heard by the rest of the band.
Ah, yeah, so yeah.
It actually is a problem a lot. We struggle with that in Armored Saint as well, believe it or not. And it's been a problem at times. You do need somebody to be the catalyst for a band. I'm not really a believer, and I'm going out of line here. I'm in a limb here. I'm going to tell you this stuff, and I just don't care anymore. I do interviews, and I kind of just talk. And I'm like, is that going to bite me in the ass later? But I don't, I mean, what do I care? I'm 60 years old. I'm not talking any smack.
Right, right. And if you want to cut anything, we can cut. We're just talking, you know.
I'm just being honest. You know, somebody has to lead the band. It's just the way it is. You're not going to have a complete democracy in a group. It just doesn't work. It doesn't. So, you know, Anthrax is an unusual band because Charlie Benante writes all the music, or the bulk of the music, should I say, and it wrote the riffs for Indians and I Am the Law and Madhouse. And, you know, it's like, it's rare. It's very rare for the drummer to do that. And he's a very talented guy. And then Scott wrote all the lyrics. So it was like, and I came in and I contributed for sure, but it was just a different dynamic than most bands. But that's the way it worked, and that was how it happened. You know, everyone contributes once the ball gets rolling, and they contribute their ideas and their parts. But it's just somebody has to be the catalyst. It's just usually the guitar singer. That's the way it usually has works for hard rock through the years. You know, it's not my law. It's just the way it is, man. You know,
right.
Plan pays. Phil Mogg, Michael Schenker, you know, it's just the way it's kind of happened. There are exceptions. Phil Lynott, bass player, you know, wrote almost the Thin Lizzy songs, or a lot of them, you know, Lemmy, Paul McCartney. I mean, you know, most drummers don't. Let's be clear about that. Somebody has to do it. Same in Armored Saint. Joey is the maestro. He's the guy who gets it going and takes ideas and then kind of creates a song out of riffs. I even tell, you know, Phil and Jeff, I'm like, don't worry so much about writing a song per se as just write the best riff of all time. That mm-hmm. is your outreach. And then we'll create a song around it, which has kind of happened. It happened on End of the Attention Span. And actually, it was Phil's title that got that song going. And I was like, that's great. I love it. That will be easy to write lyrics to that. It doesn't have to necessarily be 20%, 20%, 20%. Hey, it's democracy. It's just not true. It doesn't really work like that. Everybody can get in the band and hash it out. But times are different now, and people write stuff and put it on, make demos at home in their home studios. It's not like the yesteryear days where we all, went to our rehearsal after our day jobs, got a little high, had some beers and wrote songs and thought we were writing, a wall. And, it's like, it's just, everyone has a different life, and it just doesn't really work that way for a band like Armored Saint. I guess if you're a massive group, Iron Maiden, Metallica, you can go hole up in a rehearsal studio for months and do that. But still, Steve Harris is the guy.
Yeah.
He's still the guy, writing the bulk of the songs. Let's face it. So it's just the way it usually works. You gotta, roles are really crucial to bands. I always say that. And that goes back to the whole sports thing. Not everybody is Michael Jordan. Not everybody is LeBron James. But you need these guys around him. Scottie Pippen and Horace Grant was a killer rebounder. So was Rodman, was awesome in defenseman. John Paxson, killer shooter. So you need these people, and that's what makes championships. Is that people knowing roles, knowing that somebody may be a star, but that doesn't mean that everybody's not as important. It's usually when those lines are blurred and you can't agree, that's usually when strife happens, and that's usually when bands break up.
So just like you're saying right there that most bands need a maestro to get the music going, would you say it's the same way for the business side of things? Do you need somebody to be the spearhead to make the decisions and take it to everybody?
Probably. Again, you need somebody to be the leader. I mean, Joey Vera's managed Armored Saint up until the last 6 months. He managed us for the last 20 years. I was happy with him, but he was going bananas and, going, I'll never book a bus again. And I was like, well, you shouldn't have to book a bus. You're the guy. Why are you doing that? And then when we had him this last tour, he's booking the bus. I'm like, dude, you said you weren't going to do that anymore. And you're doing it. He's got a little controlling, which is a good thing most of the time. Because, again, you need somebody to be the guy who's the driving force.
Yeah.
He holds on pretty tight. It's benefited the band much more than it's been a problem. But, we just got the record contract for a new album. And he goes, did you read it? I was like, not really. And he's like, what? I'm like, dude. All this lawyer jargon. I'm like, I don't care about that. And there's a couple key things that were in it that were to me were beneficial, more streaming revenue, and the label is super cool. They actually waived the debt for 3 of our albums, which is super rare. And now we have 6 of our albums where we have no debt, and we have big debts with the first 3 Christmas records and also La Raza Revelation, Not of the Old School. And they wrote it off, and I was like, man, that's incredible. So to me, that's you're immediately getting royalties, and that's what you want as an artist. To me, the royalty, I don't care what the check is. If the check is $100 or if it's 10 grand, it's principal. When I get that, it's yes, I earned it. And it's been mostly closer to $100 than it is to 10 grand in my life. Trust me. But, it's just you always feel like, man, that was why I did it, And I think that's just really important. So when it comes to business, I'm terrible. I really am. And I don't want to do the business. I don't want to be the artist. I don't want to be, I take a back seat because I don't want to be that guy. And that's why it's better. All I really want to do is write lyrics and sing. And, I'm still the singer. So that's the way it's going to be. I'm the front man. But I don't have that desire to be the leader. Maybe that's been a problem. I don't really think so, but I remember way back in the day, Ron Lafitte, a good friend of ours, he was our manager, tour manager, started tour managing when he was 19. And, it's funny, him and I kind of sent texts to one another. He manages Usher now. He's some big time guy. And You know, I remember him saying back in the day, like, dude, you need to be more of a rock star. And I'm like, what does that mean? What do you mean? I got the hair, got the leather jacket, I rock. What do you? And I was like, I don't, to this day, I think he was saying, be more of a jerk. I don't, because most singers are, and I'm just really not. Don't get me wrong. I have my moments. I can be an idiot and a jerk. I can be, not often. And it's just like, I was making the joke, I'm more like a bass player, not to stereotype bass players, but I had Bill Wyman, I don't know, like, and maybe that actually is hindered my career a little bit. It might have, but it is the way it is.
Right. And John, I told you I talked to a lot of musicians and actors, so I got to ask you about the voiceover work you've done for Burger King. Are you the voice of the Whopper?
That was years ago. I wish I still was, but that was so long ago. It was like 7 to 10. It was awesome. Don't get me wrong. It was killer. It was fun. Made a lot of rad commercials and really funny stuff. And highlight was doing the Simpson movie commercial tied in with Burger King. I'm trying to get back into it. I have an audition I have to do today for some animated. He's a rock guy. I don't really know what it is. I'm supposed to not talk about it. It's some kind of animated thing. But I'm like, okay, I could pull that off. But I don't know if I'll get the job. But it's very, very competitive in the voiceover world now. You got big time actors doing that, and they kind of squash the little guy. And it's just a lot of people doing it. You can do it from home, and so it's just a very competitive world. It's fun. I love it. To me, it's just a using my voice in a different way. It's acting, but it's not acting. I'm not on camera. My wife's a casting director, and she casts a lot of commercials, and I work with her, and I see all the work that actors put into it, and it's a lot of work, and it's a lot, little payoff. Of course, we all know the famous people, but there's all the other people that are just, just battling every day to get auditions, let alone jobs. And it's a real competitive world. That's why they had the SAG strike, because they were trying to really help out the little guy. The big time actors, they're not worried about money, but the little guys were. And that was a cool gesture, because a lot of people supported them that were higher level. And apparently they got some good things in the contract when they renegotiated. But I don't know. It's fun. It's a cool thing to do. I got a new agent, Jeff Buttermark, our manager, helped me get a new agent, which I was real grateful for too. To get a new person to help me get auditions, and they have. So of course now I'm going on tour. So it's like, I mean, two things from the road. It's not so easy, of course, but it's a fun world. I really dig it.
Best musical advice you've been given, and who gave it to you?
Well, I can't really remember anything very specific, to be honest with you. If I was giving advice, what I always say is just to listen to lots of music, be very broad in the music that you listen to, and try to let that kind of seep into your DNA and your pores, and then let that combination of all these different things kind of help nurture something that's unique in yourself, and through personality, make you a special musician. So, again, music, it's a real super competitive world. You got all these youngsters coming up, Guitar Hero stuff, that are like, just, they're shredders. They're incredible. The technical ability of a lot of people, drummers, are just amazing. The key component, I think, is to, how do you do that in a way to make yourself unique and stand out from the pack? That's the true goal, is to do something where you have the ability, but do you have the style? Do you have the uniqueness? And I think that's the thing that is going to be more of the challenge to people. So I think that's what I tell everybody, is to really focus on that. And I think by the way to get that is by listening to lots of different music, and to letting, if you're a metalhead, you don't only want to listen to metal. I mean, I think that'd be the worst thing you could possibly do. It's going to start emulating other people. It's just going to happen. I mean, of course, you're going to listen to it because you love it. But then also listen to some jazz, and listen to, John Coltrane. And I listen to classical music, man, to the chagrin of my wife. And like, dude, really? And I'm like, yeah. It's just, I think that's really the important thing. So I don't know if anybody's ever, I can't specifically remember something specific, but that's what I would say. I think that's important.
Good advice. So it's something I like to ask everyone just because you never know. Have you ever had an experience you would consider supernatural or paranormal?
Yeah, I had an incident years ago. My dad had passed away, and he did die in the house that we were, myself and my brothers were raised in. My mom, a few years later, was moving, and so we were kind of packing everything up. It was like the last couple of days before we were going to leave that house that we were raised in. We were there for 30 years. You know, my dad and I, we were never really that close. Of course, I always loved my father. He's this kind of gruff Italian guy, and we bonded over the Dodgers and Sanford and son. That was really the connection. He was there for me, but, you know, more for taking me to sports and supporting my music career. But, you know, there wasn't a lot of communication, quite frankly. But, you know, he was my dad. And there was a weird moment where a friend of mine from the neighborhood, his name was Channing Estrada. He was a kid, grew up in the neighborhood. Channing was in our first band in the talent show. He was a great bass player. He was there because he lived in the neighborhood. And it was a couple of days before we were moving. And it was just him and I. And at one point, it was actually him that had it. He goes, "Is somebody here?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "Oh, I just saw somebody walk, you know, down that hallway." And I was like, "What?" And so, you know, we went and we looked, and there was nothing. And then, ironically enough, I think we had ordered some food, and like probably like 2 minutes later, the doorbell rang, and just both of us. But it was a weird thing, and you know, I'm not sure how I feel about ghosts and all that, really, to be honest. But it was weird, and it was just like literally 2 days later, or 3 days later, we were moving out of the house. So it was maybe the feeling of like, oh, he's checking out the pad. Mm-hmm. Where he lived and kind of showing he was there. And I didn't really feel scared, although I am getting some goosebumps right now just saying it. I didn't feel fear. It was more of like just, I don't think it kind of made me like sad because that was like, I probably didn't really mourn my dad like I should have. And then maybe that was like, it would kind of hit me. It's like, whoa. And then again, this is probably like a couple years maybe after he died, or I don't remember the time frame exactly, but it was a trippy moment. And that's the one I always kind of remember.
That's a great story, man. Just to put a bow on everything here, John, and I'm going to get you out of here. I know you guys are going on tour. Just tell folks what's on the horizon for you, where they can find you and all that good stuff.
Well, they can find us throughout the country. Unfortunately, we're not playing South Carolina. We're playing Charlotte, which is always a great rock show. We had an awesome show there with Wasp, and we're playing Atlanta and so kind of surrounding areas. And it's a long tour. Not going to get through without any health issues and with the sanity in place at the end. It's going to be a fun tour. And, it should be great. Queensryche is an incredible band, and they've always been real supportive of us through the years. And it should be a great tour.
I think you guys are playing the Masquerade in Atlanta. My wife and I are definitely going to get out of that one.
Oh, please do. That's always a great gig. Always a fun show.
There you go, brother. Thank you so much for giving me some of your time, John. Big fan.
Great interview. Thanks a lot, dude, for just, you know, just talking and asking some really interesting questions, and it just feeling very natural. Appreciate that.
Thank you, bro. You have a great rest of your day.
Even my wife say from the distance, I was one of the better ones.
Thank you.
I've seen a lot of them.
Right, bye-bye, man.
Please, all right, we'll see. Make sure you say hello to me in Atlanta, all right?
I will. I'll send a message to Liz or something.
Yeah, please do.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, brother. See ya.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. I hope you enjoyed that chat with John. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you back next time.
Monsters, madness, and magic.
9th You think you know Night Demon? Then the Night Demon Heavy Metal Podcast is for you. Step into the darkness as we peel back the curtain to give you an unprecedented, all-access look into the mind and the heart of the demon. We're talking band history, song analysis, studio anecdotes, stories from the road. It's everything a diehard Night Demon fan could want and more. This is the only place to learn the inside scoop, the deep dive trivia, the untold tales from the band members themselves and those closest to the Night Demon story. Need more? The sacred Night Demon Crypt will be pried open to reveal demo recordings that have never before seen the light of day, all with in-depth commentary by the band and the people who were there for the writing and recording process. This is a gold mine, a treasure trove of all things Night Demon. Head over to nightdemon.net or wherever you listen to podcasts.